Speaker, he's been getting a lot of unwanted attention from the media these days. A couple of weeks ago, Scottish News TV did a special report to emphasize his importance in the alt-right, and given how prolific he is, I wouldn't underestimate his influence. And yeah, we're welcoming him here to Ireland for the first time, very eloquent and loyal to the truth, very honest. Millennial woes, please.
Okay, thank you. All right, well, let me... Okay, now, this is supposed to last about 45 minutes. I'll do my best. It might not be that long, or it might be a bit longer. But I'll try to keep it interesting. So, I'm going to discuss the concept of speech crime. Sorry, is this working okay? Yeah. Okay, can you hear me better now? Okay. All right, so I'm going to discuss the concept of speech crime. And I think it's important to say at the start, I'll just detach that. It's important to say at the start that there is no criminal act that is actually called speech crime. It's very much a concept. But the concept is useful to us because it encapsulates a phenomenon that we are increasingly seeing and that is increasingly being used against us, and to characterize our entire worldview as nationalists. Now, one of the things we hear often nowadays is, well, you do have free speech, but free speech doesn't mean freedom from consequences for what you say. But I do think that's rather disingenuous. Free speech ideally would mean that you will not face consequences either socially, professionally, or legally from what you say. When they say you have free speech, they mean legally, but not socially or professionally. Now, socially you can't control, obviously, but professionally and in other ways, I think it could be more protected than it is. However, fat chance of that happening because it's now being attacked on the legal level as well, and has been for some time. Now, one thing I want to say from the start is, I think we can be a bit self-righteous as underdogs. We can be a bit self-righteous about how much free speech we would tolerate. Because after all, which of us would be happy to, for example, knowingly serve a communist in our shop? I would find it irritating. I would find it annoying. I wouldn't be rude to the person, but I would be thinking, God, it would be nice if I could just ban them from my shop because I can't stand their ideas. So in a sense, and that maybe I'm just speaking for myself, fair enough, but I think in a sense that there is a danger that we play too much on the martyr thing, because I understand why your opinions are associated with you as a person, and you as a person are to some extent defined by your opinions. I think that is a realistic, it's just an inevitable, natural thing that people do. However, to move on to the reality of things today, leftists say that our ideas, what they call hate speech, are not legitimate because they harm people. Our ideas apparently harm people. That's the rationale. Or is it? Do they object to our ideas because hate speech violates their worldview? It's not so much the direct harm that it causes, or even the indirect harm, but that it rests on assumptions that they find offensive to their worldview. Now, when you see the hysteria that can be induced in a devoted progressive by a few mere words, it is difficult to see it as anything other than a religious impulse. I've said this many times, that I think in the absence of religion, certainly in Scotland and England and America, I think as religion recedes, people look for new ways to be good and to prove their goodness. And with that in mind, we can perhaps sympathize to some extent with what leftists are going through when they suffer our ideas. It is an intellectual disturbance, but more important than that, it is a spiritual disturbance. At threat is not just an idea or a belief that they hold, but their entire worldview and their very conception of themselves in the world, living this life. So I would say let's have some humility, for those who are offended by our ideas. And as I said earlier, let's admit that we too are offended by other people's ideas. It hurts to hear things that contradict our worldview. An old friend betrays you when they suddenly announce that they're a progressive or an SJW or Antifa or something like that. It does feel like, my God, I thought I knew you. And now we're on opposite sides of a divide. And I obviously think that my side is the correct one and yours is the stupid one. So you've betrayed me. And again, I can understand why the left feel this way about us and why they're offended and upset. But those emotional reactions are no way to run a society. Now, at first, the definition of hate speech in Britain, in Scotland and England was speech that is intended or likely to incite racial or religious hatred. Now, even that makes it difficult to state certain truths, because certain truths are likely to encourage hatred of the people you're talking about. For example, Rotherham. I'll get onto that later, briefly. But now, that was the original definition, speech that is intended or likely to incite racial or religious hatred. But now, there is an informal definition of hate speech that is being used, including by the police. And that is speech that is motivated by hostility towards a group. And that is a much broader definition, and it covers a much wider range of possible statements. In fact, it covers basically any statement as long as the person making it was motivated by hostility. Now, for example, if I say that Black Americans have an average IQ of 85, is that okay for me to do, to say that? To make that statement, until the occasion when I make that statement while feeling hostile towards them. So is it okay for me to say it in a calm setting, but then when one of them mugs me and then I'm feeling hostile, is it then a crime for me to say it? This is the kind of nonsense that we're going to have to consider, and that we do have to consider. And in effect, what this means, this new definition, what it means is that you can't say anything about a group that you don't like, because someone can always attribute it to hostility, irrational, hateful hostility towards them. And then there is the new definition, international definition, of anti-Semitism, which, if not a component of hate speech legislation, can certainly be invoked as justification for calling something a hate crime. And as soon as something you've done is called a hate crime, you're in serious trouble. And this new definition of anti-Semitism, which has even been adopted in America, thus possibly abolishing by stealth the First Amendment, includes certain remarks about Jews which are clearly true as a group. Namely, that they have disproportionate influence in Western societies. And the wording is... making stereotypical allegations about Jews as such, or the power of Jews as a collective, such as the myth of Jews controlling the media, economy, government, or other societal institutions. And really, I try to be moderate about this matter, but it is clearly true that they do have disproportionate influence in the media, the economy, the government, and other societal institutions. So it is a fact. And so, and you only have to look at the infographics of the CNN staff to know that. So are we just meant to not mention this? Is it something that we're supposed to not notice? Or are we allowed to notice it, but then we can't see it? How insane is this going to get? I mean, the point I'm making here is that these are just truths, and there are certain truths that are on the way to becoming illegal to state. Sometimes given the circumstances, sometimes just in and of themselves. And then, there is the fact that, as I said, certain truths are very difficult to speak without tempting your audience towards hating the people that you're talking about. Can I say that Pakistani Muslims raped 1,400 white girls in Rotherham and now commit 75% of the child rapes in the West Midlands without tempting my audience to hate Pakistani Muslims? It's rather difficult. It's rather a fine line. Because after all, is it not a hateable thing that they have done? Is their behaviour not hateable? Would you do what they have done and not expect to be hated for it? So how can we talk about Rotherham without inciting hatred? Now, for normies, as we call them, the attitude towards hate speech and free speech and all that tends to be something like, just keep things calm and predictable in my life. They don't want people to be censored, but they'd rather people didn't say things that other people wanted to censor. And they imagine that the only things most people want to censor are unreasonable things. So, of course, in their view, they just want people to be reasonable. And this belief is encouraged, of course, by the left, who will basically intimate that the only things we, the left, want to censor are hateful things, hate speech. But it is not as straightforward as that. Because while the left, while the claim is that the left want to stop hateful speech, the fact is speech crime just happens to encompass every statement that one naturally wants to voice if one is a nationalist. And nothing that one would naturally want to say as a progressivist or globalist is encompassed by speech crime. Absolutely nothing. You are free to say whatever egalitarian, progressive, or globalist stuff you want, and you will never be sanctioned for it. You will never be reprimanded for it, and you'll barely even be questioned for it. But as a nationalist, virtually every premise of nationalism is either speech crime or verging on it. So there's always this leftward push with speech crime as a sort of spectre haunting society. For example, Germaine Greer is now guilty of speech crime because she says that male-to-female transsexuals are not women. And some of you might know about this. The third-wave feminists are disavowing second-wave feminists because of this disagreement. But what does the disagreement rest on? It rests on the idea that there are men and there are women. The second wave feminists were sane enough to believe that. The third wave feminists don't even want to accept that. So what we have here is that whatever aids the entropic processes of the left is categorized as good, common sense, obvious, or inevitable, or virtuous. Whereas whatever obstructs the entropic processes of the left is categorized as speech crime, or at least conceptualized as that. So we're in a situation where to speak certain truths is virtually a crime. The ability of us, white people, as a group to be recognized, the fact of our being a group now and in the past, and the prospect of our remaining a group in the future, are all denied, and by various forces in society, political correctness and so on. And meantime, if we complain about this, or if we name the particular group who are masterminding this in general and coming up with the ideas to keep it going, then we are guilty of speech crime. We are guilty. So the purpose of speech crime then is to ensure that our spiraling descent into oblivion continues. But you could also add other definitions. You can add other purposes to it. You could say that the purpose of speech crime is to ensure that cultural Marxism, the molecule which is running through our spiritual fabric and dissolving it, is never combated. Cultural Marxism can be politely questioned, but only so that the questioner can be pigeonholed as an idiot. The doctrine itself can never really be, well, it can be questioned, but never actually combated, and certainly never rejected. And speech crime ensures this. Another purpose of it is to ensure that mass immigration continues. I have to say that Dublin is very white from what I can see, from what I've seen since landing. Certainly the area where I'm staying is very, very white. And it's a novelty for me. And you know, I've been living all over Europe this year, and everywhere I go, well, I mean, this is just a tangent, really, but basically what I'm saying is that I hope Dublin does remain like this. But then again, I haven't seen the centre of it, so maybe it's just as bad. The point is, mass immigration is everywhere you go now. And the purpose of speech crime is to ensure that it continues, and that we, in this case, Dubliners, white Irish, do not recognise themselves as a group. And it's the same in Sweden and Germany. Everywhere. Everywhere. So the purpose of speech crime is to stop us complaining, to stop us waking each other up, to stop us mobilising, to stop us gaining control of the narrative, and thus influencing the public at large. One other purpose of speech crime is to make it possible to attack, demonise, isolate, and paralyse those of us who do dare to speak out, and thus make examples of us. The ultimate purpose of speech crime is to destroy us, to destroy our peoples. But perhaps the wickedest thing about speech crime is that it uses our goodness against us. Just as the migrant crisis utilises the openness, compassion and kindness of white people to persuade them to welcome, feed and clothe the invader and thus destroy themselves, just as degenerate subcultures utilise the uniquely white traits of curiosity and zesty rebelliousness, or the will to conquest, to persuade white people to despise their traditional cultures and thus destroy themselves, just as multiculturalism utilises the uniquely white trait of curiosity to persuade white people to give up their traditional cultures and thus destroy themselves. In the same way, speech crime utilises white people's desire for politeness, decency, fairness, and mutual respect, and thus persuades them to be happy with censorship, because it protects vulnerable minorities from unfair insults, discrimination, and harm. And I can understand how that appeals to the pathologically altruistic white person, it's the average white person. So the short-term result of this is that vulnerable minorities are protected from unfair harm. The long-term result of it, though, is that newly invulnerable minorities are allowed to rape 1,400 white girls in Rotherham, and nobody talks about it. Nobody does anything about it. And the end result, of course, is that white people destroy themselves. Also, another thing about speech crime is it uses white people's respect for, not worship of, but their respect for communitarianism against them. Their respect for the morals of other people and for the morals of the community, the mores of the community. Each person's desire to conform and to not draw attention to themselves. And obviously the farther north in Europe you go, the more this trait manifests in what you have, what we call Jantelagen in Sweden and Scandinavia. But it's there, it's here as well. You know, that this, there is a, certainly in Scotland, and I would fully expect that it's in Ireland as well, this trait that you just don't draw attention to yourself. You don't think you're better than other people. And that's part of being polite. It's part of respecting the community and respecting your place in the community. Well, unfortunately, in an age of like ours, that means don't put your head above the parapet about the fact of your people being replaced. And so it has dire consequences. And another more surprising thing that speech crime utilises is white people's respect for individualism. It uses that against them as well. It, essentially, the thinking is, you are responsible for the person that you become. You have all these choices. The end result is your responsibility. It's not, you can't blame your community or your society, it's you. You are an individual and you are empowered. And you should have ambition, because you could be a winner. You could do anything you like in life. But only if you have the right set of values. So why choose to be a low-quality person with low-quality beliefs and opinions? And thus, speech crime again persuades the white person, the well-meaning white person, to put up with anything. In this case, again, the destruction of their people. Okay. So there have been some recent high-profile speech criminals. James Watson, the discoverer of DNA or co-discoverer of DNA, who said that Africans are, all the evidence says that they're not really as intelligent as us. And then Brendan Eich, he invented JavaScript. I believe he was one of the founders of Mozilla. And he was found to have donated to the anti-gay cause or anti-gay marriage cause. And he, of course, was pilloried and forced to resign from Mozilla. And then there was Matt Taylor, because these things happen so often that we tend to forget them. Matt Taylor was the NASA scientist with the misogynistic shirt. And he was destroyed on what should have been the best day of his life. And it was heartbreaking and it was disgusting that feminists really took him apart. And he was actually crying on camera, if I remember correctly. And then there was Tim Hunt, the scientist who said that women are more emotional than men. And again, his life was basically ruined. And then James Damore, more recently, the Google employee, published this infamous diversity manifesto. And he's paid the price as well. He's lost his job, and he's now persona non grata among Silicon Valley, I believe. And then, of course, more locally, there's George Hook, the Irish radio presenter who talked about women protecting themselves and not making themselves vulnerable to rape. And he is being taken apart. So the truth is, the mainstream media will try to punish you for what you say, and they'll be very good at it, amazingly good at it. They see it, or at least they pretend to see it, as their moral duty to identify the perpetrator, to visit his home, to plaster his face across the newspapers, and to write appalling things about him. And if the speech crime is against the doctrine of feminism or trans rights, the attacks on the perpetrator will be largely motivated by a desire to maintain the status quo and the harmony of public discourse. It's largely preemptive, because these are low priority nowadays, trans and feminism. And they want to make an example of the person so as to discourage other people. They will say that the person is stupid, and so on. But feminism and trans rights are low priority. So the purpose of punishing speech criminals here is really just to keep women animated in the socio-political struggle, to keep them awake and feeling oppressed. But if your speech crime is against the doctrines of racial equality, egalitarianism, open borders, or multiculturalism, especially racial equality, then the attacks on the perpetrator will be much more vicious. It's not preemptive, it's an outright assault, a witch hunt, and it is meant to have a purgative effect on society in general, or is meant to seem, I mean, that's the purported goal of it. It's to cleanse society of this madman, this witch, this demon. And then obviously, I will use this opportunity to talk about my own case of speech crime earlier this year. I haven't talked about it for a while. I talked about it a wee bit at the time, but obviously there was a lot going on that I didn't want to say at the time. But it's all basically water under the bridge now. I think it's probably safe to be more candid about it. And the first thing to say is that I started my YouTube channel very naively and innocently 4 years ago almost, and I was just saying literally whatever I thought, because, I mean, I was slightly careful about saying racist stuff at first. And then within 2 months or so, I was just being completely open about my views, my opinions, my suspicions about things. And I don't really think I ever hesitated to say anything for a good year, at least. And so that's how it started. But it was not political. It wasn't activism. It was just curiosity, basically. But 3 years later, the newspapers heard about me because of the NPI conference in November last year in DC, and took it upon themselves to track me down, to identify me. And some local Scottish Antifa took part in that as well. I'm not sure to what extent. And it was a witch hunt. And it started at about the 20th of November. And then for the rest of that year, they were trying to find me. And then at the very start of 2017, they did find me. And on the, I think it was the 5th of January, someone turned up at my front door, which was extremely disturbing, because I still had the idea that the channel was just my thing and I would talk to the world, but it wouldn't be the world. It would be those who were interested. It'd be basically my potential friends who would see the videos. That was still the conception of the channel in my mind. I knew that I was talking, that I had a potential audience of the public, but I never really treated it that way. I always treated it as an intimate conversation between friends. And so the idea that people who wished me harm would be listening in on that conversation, would be watching those videos as well and making notes, disturbed me. And then, of course, the idea that my anonymity could be taken away. I mean, it's not surprising. People have said, surely you should have expected this. And surely I should have. But I don't think it ever, I don't know. At some level, I did expect, and at another level, I just thought, well, I've managed 3 years now, who cares? It's, you know, this'll be fine. And if they do find me, so what? And I was naive about it. I didn't realize how traumatic it would be when some piece of shit turns up at your front door who wants to ruin your life. It is unnerving. Of course, I've got to be careful what I say, because they will watch this and they will feel good about themselves. They will enjoy it. So, I was described in the most ridiculous ways by national newspapers, in particular the Scottish Daily Record, whose journalist Alan McEwen made it his mission to demonise me, calling me a racist scumbag, and he was the one who constantly used the word vile to describe me. I'm vile, which I actually did find very funny at the time, because it's just so over the top. Hold on a second. And he was the one, he was the third one who showed up at the door. First one was some guy from a newspaper called The National, called Andrew Learmonth. He was the one on the Thursday. And he's just this guy there, and he said, "Hello, Colin. I want to talk to you about millennial woes." It was very strange. Very strange indeed. And of course, I knew at that instant, okay, I've been found. They know where I live. They know who I am. And then you realize, my God, I have actually been committing some kind of moral crime in the eyes of many people. I don't know if I'd ever committed a legal crime. I think I would have heard about it by now if I had. I think the police would have visited me. But anyway, you do feel like a type of criminal. It's bizarre. Because I certainly never intended to, you know, be evil or be be horrible. But that's how it feels. And you realize, as I was going to say earlier, that you realize that the anonymity which you had and which was your protection and which you took for granted, the newspapers think, well, you are a man. You have been doing something anonymously. It is a wrong thing that you've been doing. So why should you have that anonymity? And we can take it from you, and we will, because it's the good thing to do. It's the right thing to do. How dare you expect to have anonymity? The public will want to know who you are. I'll get onto this in a minute, the thing about the public interest, which is just utter drivel. But anyway, I'll get to that in a minute. So here's what happened. They described me in these ridiculous ways. And then as a result of all this, and it was 3 days running, and then there were more, I think, in the Scottish Herald, and then another one in the evening. I can't remember now, but it was a spate of articles about me, including the front page of the Daily Record. My face plastered there. And as a result of all of that, My relatives were questioned at work by their managers. I lost a quarter of my Facebook friends, and I think it would have been more had a higher percentage of my Facebook friends been British. A lot of them were American. I fled my country, Scotland. That was mostly for my relatives' sake. I knew that there was some danger to me, but I didn't think it would be... The main reason I left was for my relatives' sake. And I still don't know whether I will ever return to live in Scotland. I'm not sure. I don't think the danger is huge anymore, if it ever was. What I'm more concerned about is just the ability to have a relatively peaceful life. I don't think I would get beaten to death or anything like that. Well, you never know. But the saddest effect of all is that most of my immediate family don't want anything to do with me anymore. And basically, I have lost my family. So that is the power of speech crime. This is what we're talking about. This is how serious it can be for any of you, any of us. It's not something to take lightly. Now, some advice. Should any of you find yourselves being branded speech criminals, here is what I would do, and I'll be making a separate video at some point giving advice to people to whom this happens. But what I'll say now is, state your positions very clearly and do it ideally on your own platform, your own channel, your own blog, so that even if it does get distorted in the repeating by the media, your original version is there for people to see and hear and read. Never do interviews with the media unless you can record the thing in full and upload it to your own platform. If they don't agree to that, don't do it. And even if they do agree to that, I would still say be careful about saying yes to it. Think about what you're getting and what you're possibly going to suffer for it. Another thing, never apologize for your speech crime. It doesn't work. It doesn't stop them demonizing you. In fact, it only encourages them because they smell blood. They're glad that you have humiliated yourself by apologizing, but they will still want everyone else to disavow you. And they still want you to be punished because it satisfies their sadism and because it satisfies their vindictive sense of justice. And because they want the public in general to see that they too will be punished, and the same thing will happen to them. So it's essential not that the perpetrator of speech crime realizes his crime and so on, but that he is destroyed for his crime. And if you apologize, then you aid them in doing that to you. And any other, and then the other thing is that it's essential to them that the perpetrator of speech crime is defined wholly by his speech crime. So there is nothing else of interest about you. You are just this guy who did this evil thing. And you're not really a human being. The only interest they'll have in other details about you is incriminating details that they can use to demonize you. You're eccentric, you're Walter Mitty, you're a loser, you live with your dad, whatever it is. So, never apologize. Always force them to justify their worldview. In fact, that would be really the best way to handle an interview. Get them to justify their premises and their so-called concerns. Put them on the back foot and get them to defend what they say. Now, bear in mind that their attacks on you will be personal, discrediting you, rather than argumentational. Bear in mind that a single statement by you will be twisted to mean that 100% in all situations and applying to all members of that group, you believe that statement. For example, I once made a video about some awful feminist who was reading it was a sort of comedy routine where she was making fun of men's desire for respect and how I was saying that's a crucial part of being a man. You want to build something, make something of yourself. And so this feminist was cheapening a core part of male identity, male psychology. And she was going on and on about it, like 10 minutes, all these endless jokes. And I said in my video, I wouldn't blame any man for wanting to punch that woman in the face. Well, unfortunately, that means that I hate women. It means that I hate all women, apparently. So there we go. That's just an example of how one thing... I mean, honestly, I still wouldn't blame any guy for wanting to punch her in the face because she was awful. She was an awful woman doing a very socially destructive thing. So obviously I'm not advocating that that happens, but I'm saying I understand the anger that a man might feel watching that that video of that woman. But that does not mean that I think all women... of course it doesn't. But of course that's what the paper said about me. That was their evidence that I hate women. So, yeah, bear in mind that a single statement by you will be magnified and put in isolation, presented in isolation as the totality of your view on that subject. Bear in mind that these people, press and so on, have lawyers on call. Bear in mind that they know exactly what they're doing and that they will not make any mistakes that could make them legally culpable. Bear in mind that they don't necessarily believe a word that they say about you. They are mercenary scum. Bear in mind that any photos that you have shared publicly can be reprinted by them. That's a sort of separate thing. And furthermore, bear in mind that their only goal is to make people think badly of you. And they will use anything that they can find towards that goal. And then, if you speak about what they have done to you, they will say that you are feeling sorry for yourself, trying to gain sympathy, manipulating people, and manufacturing a martyr image for yourself. So, yeah, they'll hurt you, they'll damage you, they'll cause you all that stress, and then when you comment on it, they'll say that you're feeling sorry for yourself. So that's why I call them mercenary scum. And then furthermore, bear in mind that the press ombudsman, the press standards people, will probably take their side, as they did in my case. Not a single one of the, you know, they basically found that none of the newspapers had done anything wrong at all, whatever. So they will justify doing all of this to you by saying that it is in the public interest for you to be identified, physically located, harassed at your home, and mercilessly demonized. In the public interest. Which has two meanings, obviously. The first is that it is interesting to the public. And the second is that it's of benefit to the public, beyond mere curiosity or sating or whatever. It's useful to the public to know this stuff. That is different from it being interesting to the public. And so they conflate those two. It's a sleight of hand. And of course, the irony is that this stuff actually isn't interesting to the public. I don't think. I don't think that the typical reader of the Daily Record would read that article about me and think, oh dear, what a villain. I think they don't care. And even middle class types, do they really care about this? I don't think so. I think the media are very much talking to themselves and to each other. They're virtually signaling to each other for promotion purposes and all that. But also, let's not underestimate that they are building a world. They're fashioning society in what they do. So it's not just entirely selfish. So, why do they do this? It is in the mainstream media's interest. It is, well, that's the thing. It's in their interest, not in the public's interest. It's in their interest to do this because it allows them to protect their narratives. And it is interesting to operatives of the mainstream media and the progressive lobbying sector, including vindictive organizations like Hope Not Hate. So this is the point. It's really an entirely selfish thing by the progressive lobbyists and the academia and the media themselves, who are being very mercenary about it. I think some of them will genuinely be political, progressive, leftist, but I don't think... That doesn't seem to cover the venom. That doesn't justify the full venom with which they treat people. So I think a lot of it is just they're doing it for the money. But they will still do it. So be aware of that. Because ultimately they know the power of speech, of mere words. You know, we can say, and this is a difficult thing, We can say, you know, sticks and stones and all that, but sticks and stones can change the world. They are important, politically important, even if not emotionally potent. They are socially, you know, these are ideas. Now, if I were a dictator, I'm going to be honest here, I would be tempted to have censorship, speech crimes even. I would be tempted. Because I'm a human being and I have my own ideas about how the world should be, and I don't want people disagreeing with me. You know, I want people to agree with me and we can all just get it done, you know? That would be simple. and I would probably say something like this. If I were a dictator, I would justify it to myself like this. Ideas are very interesting and all, but what does this cultural Marxism lead to? Nihilism, atomization, confusion, and oblivion. So why should we allow them to preach it? Why should we give them that free speech? But then our enemies would say the same of us. Maybe you have a point about identity, but what does this identitarianism lead to? Mass violence and the gas chambers. So why should we allow you to have your blog, your podcast, your Facebook post, your YouTube channel, your Patreon account, and so on? And so, as ever, we have to settle for mutual freedom if we want to be morally consistent. And that's a question in of itself, really. Do we want to be morally consistent, or do we just want to win? I don't know, and I'm not going to pretend to answer that here. But I think that if we are to be morally consistent, then we have to say, okay, give us our freedom of speech to say what we want, and we'll give you yours to say what you want. It's an annoying, muddy compromise. My own solution in the real world would be this. Total free speech for the natives or the historically dominant group of a society. But no guarantee of free speech at all for immigrants and members of the non-dominant group in that society, especially immigrants, newcomers, and their children and grandchildren. So, for example, any non-white who advocated Sharia or celebrated a jihadi attack or said that Islam is going to take us over would be deported along with his family that day in my world. I would also implement a sensible degree of moral censorship of the arts, so that degrading exploitative works like The Human Centipede wouldn't, well, that would be banned under my dictatorship. But to emphasize, for the natives of each country, total free speech. Because I think it's the only way that you can, I think it's just a necessity, basically. Because you are dealing with adults, and adults have to have that freedom. It's a matter of dignity, I think. Now, finally, the landscape of debate is changing. Online, we had become accustomed to basically total free speech. What with Facebook, their censorship was always lackluster. They never knew what they were doing. And then, of course, YouTube, which was even more free than Facebook. Facebook have always been trying to zero in on social things and psychological things, and God knows what algorithms they have. But they've always been trying to do that. They've never actually been any good at it until recently. But YouTube is just useless. I mean, all they can do is get people to flag the videos and you know, trusted flaggers. So we've had basically total free speech. And the real world has never caught up with that. The real world, there are still people expect politeness and decency, and they don't want to be faced with surprising, shocking remarks. So that's the real world. It's still as it was basically 20 years ago. But now the online world is starting to resynchronize with the real world. Facebook's censorship is becoming very overbearing. I think I've actually been locked out of my Facebook account 6 or 7 times this year alone. And YouTube are shutting down channels. And web hosting companies and domain registrars are starting to shut down websites. I'm sure everyone's aware of the Daily Stormer's tribulations over the last few months. So it would be nice if the American First Amendment were to be enforced upon internet companies. But then it would also be nice if it were to be enforced on European countries. And there's not much chance of that. And I also think there is no appetite for enforcing total free speech on internet companies either. Nobody cares enough. And therefore, they will be free to censor us increasingly in the near future. And that is why I say again that what we need is our own infrastructure, a total web platform, the domain register, the web host, DDoS protection, everything. So the public might not care about the concept of speech crime. I think they find it kind of ridiculous, actually. They expect that people can say basically whatever they want because their horizons are fairly narrow. They don't understand what the extreme things that people might want to say. So the public can be fairly naive about this. But they are up for it. I think they do believe in freedom of speech. But the movers and shakers in our society do believe in speech crime, in the concept. And they are very prepared to use it against you. They will try to ruin your life, and they will alienate you from your friends, your relatives, and they can succeed in doing that. They know how to do it to you. Which, unfortunately, forces the polarization further and forces us to band together all the more tightly, to help each other, to look after each other, to encourage each other, to reassure each other. It does mean that you will be alienated from the mainstream and possibly from your past life, but you will never be alone. The nationalist community is good in that way, very good in that way. In conclusion, to tell the truth in our age is indeed a revolutionary act. Committing speech crime can have consequences legal, professional, and personal. But it is increasingly the moral and right thing to do, to commit what we call speech crime. However, you will pay a price for it. So I'll end with this one piece of advice. If you're going to make statements, if you're going to annoy people, if you're going to threaten the status quo, if you're going to commit speech crime, make it worth it. Thank you.